Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the darkened corridors of power and we shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. Well, we're starting a little bit late, but as they say on the airlines, we'll make up for the time while we're in the air. With Bernie Sanders holding the lead as we come into Super Tuesday, which is today, the Stop Bernie forces on the moderate side insist that Bernie can't win in November. But what if he is the only candidate who could truly overwhelm Donald Trump? Can his movement of young people inspired to vote counterbalance those moderate Republicans who might switch from Trump to either a Biden or a Bloomberg? Weighing in on this issue on Wiki Politiki Radio is Middle East scholar Stephen Zunis, who recently wrote a piece for Truthout debunking the idea that a progressive candidate cannot win the general election. Zunis, who as a teenager worked for George McGovern campaign, insists that the comparison between McGovern, who lost in a landslide, and Sanders holds no water. Dr. Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's recognized as one of the country's leading scholars of U.S. Middle East policy and of strategic nonviolent action. Professor Zunis serves as a senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus, the project of the Institute for Policy Studies. He is an associate editor of Peace Review and a contributing editor in Tycoon magazine. Welcome, Stephen.
Great to be with you.
Great. Okay, well, let's jump right in. Let's start with your recent article, those Democrats, party moderates alarmed by Bernie Sanders' accumulation of delegates compared his left-wing candidacy to the failed candidacy of George McGovern in 1972. Your article in Truthout was called "Sanders is Not Another McGovern. I Know I Worked on McGovern's Campaign," and it debunked that notion. So let's start there and tell us more. How is this campaign different from McGovern's campaign almost 50 years ago?
To begin with, McGovern never led in the polls against Nixon. His defeat was not a big surprise, whereas Bernie has led polls against Donald Trump for 5 years now, and there seems to be no shift in that direction. The other difference is that Nixon was actually pretty popular at that point. This is before the Watergate scandal, and he was the economy was doing great. He was winding down the war belatedly, which had been McGovern's signature issue. There was the big mess regarding Thomas Eagleton. McGovern's first running mate, where he had to remove him in a very controversial move. There was a dirty tricks campaign, which later was revealed in Watergate, designed to discredit McGovern. So frankly, there's a fair amount of disorganization in the campaign itself. Some key Democratic constituencies, like the AFL-CIO. The country's huge Trade Federation refused to endorse McGovern. By contrast, Bernie has a lot of support from Labor. They would almost certainly rally around his campaign. And, you know, Trump has been the most consistently unpopular president in history, unlike Nixon, who was riding high in the favorability ratings at the time. So confuses things is that you have this one race 48 years ago that they say, McGovern was the most progressive candidate nominated, chose a progressive, can't win. But what they miss out on is there have been a half dozen elections since then where the Democrats nominated the more conservative candidate against the progressive challenger, and they ended up losing five of those. And so, yeah. You know, it just underscores that this is not a reason to not support Bernie. I mean, if you prefer Biden to Bloomberg's policies, by all means, vote for them. But there's no reason to not vote for Bernie. And let me just throw one other thing. I am saying this as a political scientist. I'm actually supporting Elizabeth Warren. I'm not even voting for Bernie. But felt I wrote this article because I needed to respond to the nonsense we've been seeing in the mainstream media about this.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, we definitely have – it's almost as if we have three political parties. We have the Trump party. We have the neocon and neoliberal party, which might take in a few never-Trump Republicans. And then we have this progressive wave that's been building and perhaps represents the demographics of the future.
Very much so, because the sort of middle of the so-called moderate voter, the average white middle-class voter is actually probably more likely downwardly mobile and really upset at the whole system and would be far more drawn to Bernie. It's not just people of the traditional liberal left. They would much less likely to vote for a neoliberal like Biden, whose support for Wall Street deregulation, lock them up, criminal justice policy, overseas wars like Iraq and the like, these are not things that are going to get the white working class or the so-called moderate middle class to vote Democratic. Someone who really addresses their concerns are the ones who are going to do it. In fact, what's rather interesting is that if you look at the counties which went most dramatically from Bush in 2004, sorry, went from Obama in 2008 and 2012, and then went to Trump in 2016, they parallel almost exactly the counties that had the highest casualty rates from Iraq. You had Trump quite intentionally ran to Clinton's left on foreign policy, saying, "I oppose the Iraq war," which he didn't, but he said he did.
Yeah.
And Clinton clearly supported it. And he says, "I'm not going to send your sons and daughters to fight in these endless overseas wars. I'm going to bring the troops home. America first. No more of these foreign entanglements that waste our treasury and lives." And it worked. In these counties that flipped were the ones in Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania, the northern tier swing states that led to Trump's Electoral College victory. And if we nominate an anti-war candidate 4 years ago like Bernie, they would have won those voters and won those states and won the White House. And if we get Biden this time, it's going to be the same thing that happened with Clinton. We're going to lose them.
You know, there's this whole idea, the Biden mystique. I would call it perhaps the Biden mistake. But the Biden mystique is that somehow he has an appeal to white working class populist voters. Is there any truth to that?
None really. And again, especially given his record of supporting policies that are very contrary to that. Bernie has gotten very strong support from working class constituencies in Vermont, even those who had traditionally voted Republican. And because he really does speak to the issues that impact them.
Now, do you think that Elizabeth Warren can cover that same territory?
I think so. I mean, I think she has a lot of that kind of appeal. I prefer her not because I think she's not necessarily better than Biden on the, better than Bernie on the issues, on the few issues they disagree. I'm actually closer to Bernie. But I think she just has more of what it takes to actually you know, be president in terms of kind of the policy details and the you know, able to work with some of the more moderate Democrats that might get in the way of a progressive program and that kind of thing. And I think in election she could you know, be the one person who could bridge the two wings of the party. But having said that, you know, especially given you know, Bernie's lead as a more likely leading progressive contender, I have no hesitation in supporting Bernie, and I'm quite delighted he's doing so well. He's still my very close second choice.
Now, you say your background is in political science. I'm also a political scientist, although I have to confess I never got quite so far as to actually dissect a politician in poli-sci lab. I never quite got to that point. But this is something that has been interesting to me for my entire life. And so I'm worried. I'm just curious now how you got into Middle East policy. What was it that got you that sparked your interest and your obviously a lifelong so far interest in Middle East policy?
Well, I remember when I was giving a talk at the University of North Carolina a few years ago, I went to see an exhibit on the bicentennial, the founding of the university, one of the oldest public institutions in the country. And I saw a photo from the 1959 anti-war moratorium day. And there was this 13-year-old kid with a paisley shirt carrying a sign that said, U.S., get out of Vietnam, stay out of the Middle East. And I recognized that kid was me. So for a long time, I've had a sense the United States would get itself broiled in a Vietnam-style conflict in the region. And also growing up in Chapel Hill, university town, I got to meet a lot of my father's students who from the Middle East. So I kind of challenged a lot of the anti-Arab, anti-Muslim stereotypes that a lot of people had. And the moment that I think got me really thinking about was being at a demonstration against U.S. intervention in Central America. 1983, we were marching down Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C. I was talking to some people I just met. They just met each other as well. And we all agreed what was wrong with U.S. policy in Central America. But when it came to the Middle East, one guy was saying that was rationalizing for every god-awful thing the Israeli government was doing. And the other guy was saying Israel ought to be wiped off the map. And I was thinking, where's the progressive peace consensus here?
Yeah.
why are things so polarized on the Middle East when you have when we're coming together on issues of peace and human rights and international law and anti-interventionism and all these other good things elsewhere in the world? And so it just seemed like there's someone who could come in and look at the region, you know, not out of some ideological thing of Zionism or anti-Zionism or support for one particular ideological thing, but out of the same principles of peace and justice that had inspired me to become involved in anti-war movements elsewhere in the world.
You know, it's interesting. I once wrote an article on this issue. I was talking about how the jury, J-E-W-R-Y, is still out. And half of the comments accused me of being a self-hating Jew, and the other half accused me of being a Zionist apologist. So I must have been doing something right to get
the
fire
of everybody.
And so we'll talk a little bit more about the Middle East in a minute. But let's get back to this particular election. Bernie seems to have a different take on the Middle East than the other Democratic Party leading candidates. What's your take? And then let's talk about Joe Biden.
Well, Bernie Sanders, I mean, in terms of the greater Middle East, he was, back when he was in the House of Representatives, he was one of the most outspoken people against the Iraq war, pointing out that it was illegal, unnecessary, and be an utter disaster, you know, while Biden and Hillary Clinton and other Democrats were just repeating Bush and Cheney's talking points in the upper chamber. When it comes to Israel-Palestine, Bernie's been very good. I mean, he's he's gone at least as far as Jesse Jackson and Dennis Kucinich had in challenging the orthodoxy, and he speaks with authority. Not only is he Jewish, but he lived in Israel as a young man, worked on the kibbutz, and he comes out of the progressive Zionist tradition that a lot of people have sort of forgotten about now. Since the Zionist movement and the Israeli state has become now dominated by these far right-wing, rather racist militarist elements that Bernie has been quite good at calling out. Even Elizabeth Warren, who kind of started giving the Democratic Party line when she first came in to the Senate 8 years ago, has shifted dramatically. She's very, very similar to Bernie on the issue, and indeed she's gotten the support of people like Max Berger and Josh Rubner and myself, who've been fairly well known in terms of supporting Palestinian rights. But this is in contrast with Joe Biden, who, while he was in the Obama administration, quietly sought to undermine the somewhat more even-handed policy that Obama had tried to pursue. In the Senate, he was very much pro-Likud, that is, pro-occupation, pro-settlement. He's attacked the International Court of Justice. He's attacked the United Nations, and he's indirectly attacked Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other human rights groups when they've called Israel out on its violations of international humanitarian law. When Bernie and Elizabeth Warren have called on conditioning the billions of dollars of aid the U.S. provides Israel annually, Biden said that was crazy, that he would continue to have U.S. aid to Israel unconditional, no matter what Netanyahu decided to do. So this is another area in which Biden contrasts himself with the two progressive candidates remaining in the race.
Yeah, and it's interesting, but Bernie very, very vociferously refused to appear at AIPAC, probably wasn't invited. That's the American-Israel political committee.
Right.
And I think Amy Klobuchar also said that she wasn't going to attend.
Yeah, yeah. Warren was the first, followed very closely by Bernie, followed by Buttigieg, and followed by Klobuchar. And Klobuchar is a surprise because she was very similar to Biden, taking very hardline support, sympathetic in many ways to the settlements and the occupation and the like. And I think it illustrates that there's been a sea change within the Democratic constituency. It used to be you could go as far right on Israel-Palestine as you wanted, and you wouldn't hurt you politically. But now it's clear that things have shifted quite dramatically in the Democratic Party. Things have become more and more polarized. The Republicans have gotten more and more hard line in support of the occupation settlements and Netanyahu policies, and the Democrats, at least in the rank and file, are shifting to a more balanced, more J Street type approach, or even a more pro-Palestinian approach. And so the politicians running for office in the Democratic Party have to keep that into account when they take positions dealing with Israel and Palestine.
You know, it's interesting. The alt-right has been traditionally anti-Israel, perhaps anti-Semitic, but certainly anti-Zionist. And so I'm waiting for those people to somehow look at what Trump has done and go, wait a minute, we've been betrayed. Do you think there's any possibility of that?
Actually, if anything, the alt-right is shifting more and more to support to ironically support Israel, both because they would love to see the Jews leave America and go to Israel, but also but also because in certain ways the way that they see Israel as a model of an ethno-nationalist state that is trying to suppress and rid itself of Arabs, Muslims, minorities, and that's the kind of system they would like to have here.
Well, yeah, that too, and of course the rapture people and the end of the world and the destruction. We definitely want to see that temple rebuilt, and you know, of course, mm-hmm. Trump's move, perhaps, is to placate that constituency in the Republican Party that is looking to speed up the times when we get to the rapture. So
exactly, the Christian fundamentalists, especially the dispensationalist wing which consists of close to 40 million Americans, are solidly with the Republicans. And this idea that, that we need this in gathering of Jews, taking over all of Greater Palestine, and rebuilding the Solomon's Temple would bring the second coming of Christ. Now, of course, in this scenario, all the Jews would be condemned to eternal damnation. They want the Jews for Act 1, but not Act 2. They're a major constituency in the Republican Party now.
It's interesting. Everybody over there is using one another. It's really it's just like the end justifies the means, and everybody thinks they have it on the other group. You have the Israeli lobby going, hey, we can use those right wing evangelicals, and the evangelicals going, we can use those Jews, and so here we are in new word is a situation. I think we're going to take a little break now. Is that right? We're going to take a little break, and we'll be back after we hear from these commercial messages with Stephen Zunes talking about the Middle East and a little bit about the Middle West.
The best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wounds?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what's your emergency?
Okay.
911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, we're back on WikiPolitiki with our guest, Stephen Zunes, who we're talking about the Middle East. We're talking about this election here on Super Tuesday. Let's go back in history a little bit to the Iraq War, because I think that that's really was a key turning point in our Middle Eastern policy and perhaps our relationship with Iran and so on. In your opinion, what was it? Why did we go to war with Iraq? What precipitated that war? And why was it sold so heavily?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think part of it was that the United States wanted to basically extend its empire and extend its reach. They had this idea if they could take over Iraq and establish these network of major military bases, like we did in Germany and Japan following World War II, we would not only control the world's second largest oil producer, but it'd be on the border of the second, third, and fourth largest oil producers, and essentially you'll be able to control the fate of the Middle East. It was an imperial vision. I mean, it wasn't about oil in the sense of profits for the oil companies. We were actually less dependent on Middle East oil than Europe or India, China, Japan, and many others. But if we could effectively control the tap, we could use it as leverage in a future trade war or in confronting China as it rose to be a rival superpower. So I think it was about oil in a geostrategic sense, perhaps. But, you know, I really, it's crazy that people actually believe the weapons of mass destruction arguments. I mean, you know, prior to coming to the University of San Francisco, the Institute for Global Security Studies in Seattle, I like a lot of people, had studied these issues, and we knew Iraq, we figured they could have a few proscribed items stored away in a warehouse somewhere. But in terms of any operational chemical or biological weapons or our nuclear program, we knew none of that was true. And we told Biden this. We provided him with articles from arms control journals and reports from some of the top UN inspectors like Scott Ritter told Biden that Iraq had achieved at least qualitative disarmament. And Biden, as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, wouldn't let us testify. Even when Barbara Boxer specifically requested that Scott Ritter and I and Phyllis Bennis, the Institute for Policy Studies, David Courtwright at Notre Dame, other leading scholars be able to testify. Instead, Biden only allowed for a day and a half of hearings, and on here, this is the most important foreign policy decision of a generation. And he stacked the witness list with proponents of the war, including these sketchy Iraqi exiles who insisted they'd seen these supposed weapons of mass destruction with their own eyes and how, of course, the United States would be welcomed as liberators and that kind of nonsense. I mean, 90% of Mideast scholars thought invading Iraq was a bad idea. 80% of State Department specialists on the Middle East thought it was a bad idea. And yet, the Catholic Church and every mainline Protestant denomination came out against the war. Virtually every American trade union who took a position came out against the war. Not to mention, of course, the majority of Democrats and the millions of people in the streets. So Biden's decision to not only vote for the war, but actually shepherd it through the Democratic-controlled Congress and to deny war opponents an opportunity to testify makes him a pretty major character. In fact, I would argue probably the most important person in Congress in making the Iraq War resolution pass and then therefore the Iraq War possible. So this is a huge thing that so many of us have against Biden, including the fear that anyone who would support Bush launching an invasion of a country in the far side of the world that was no threat to us would, as president, demand Congress give him the same authority.
And, you know, nobody has ever paid the price for that, except for the people who died, of course. But nobody has ever been held accountable for those lies and for that railroading. And, that seems to be our political conditions, is that people actually end up getting rewarded for doing things like that.
It's stunning twice already. Every prediction I made about the Iraq war came true. I had the cover story in The Nation magazine just a few weeks before the congressional vote, the case against war. Barack Obama borrowed heavily from it in his famous anti-war speech in Chicago. Bernie Sanders and other war opponents borrowed from it as well. Pretty much everything I predicted about the sectarian conflict, the rise of Salafist extremism and terrorism, the U.S. being involved in a long, bloody counterinsurgency war and all these the regional instability, I mean, all these and the not finding weapons of mass destruction. I mean, all these things ended up being true. But the one prediction that I got wrong in this and other articles was that it would be the political ruin of any Democrat who supported it. Instead, we've had supporters of the Iraq war become vice president. They become Senate majority leader. They become the Democratic nominee in 2004 and 2016, and very possibly this year as well. But I think there's an important lesson here. Of the four elections since that time, the two where the Democrats nominated pro-war people, they narrowly lost elections they otherwise would have won. And the two times they nominated an anti-war nominee, that is Barack Obama, they won handily. I mean, Kerry and Bush was like Humphrey Nixon in 68, where a lot of people stayed home. And again, that was a very, very narrow loss. And then, as I mentioned earlier in the show, it was Biden's support. Hillary Clinton's support for the Iraq war that very likely cost her those key northern tier swing states and therefore the election.
Yep, because that's where the price was paid. That's where people came home damaged.
So we've all
beyond repair.
Yeah, ironically, a Republican-led war resulted in the loss of two elections by Democrats that they otherwise would have won had they not supported this Republican-led war.
And, you know, that's really a good analogy, Hubert Humphrey against Nixon. That was the first election I could vote. That election, and I believe I voted for Eldridge Cleaver. I'm not sure, but I didn't vote for Humphrey. You know, I probably would have voted for Bobby Kennedy, but I definitely would have voted for Bobby Kennedy. But I could not bring myself to vote for Hubert Humphrey. And I'm sure that there were young people who were 20 or 21 in 2016 who couldn't bring themselves to vote for Hillary, hence the current situation. Let's look a little bit. Go ahead. You were going to say
no. Something? Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Look a little further into the Middle East. Let's take the next domino that these people want to fall, which is Iran. Things seem to be kind of in a stalemate right now. But what's your take on the impact of the Iraq war on our relationship with Iran and where we stand and what the future might bring?
Well, it's another thing we predicted that came true is by getting rid of the vehemently anti-Iranian Saddam Hussein, and that Iran has greatly increased its influence. The United States actually encouraged the sectarian division in Iraq, believing that supporting these sectarian Shia parties would help suppress the Ba'athists and the Sunni groups that were opposing the U.S. occupation. Of course, what it did was it stoked this horrific sectarian conflict. Again, this was not ancient hatreds coming to the fore when we got rid of Saddam. This was very deliberately manipulated divide and rule by the United States. And before the invasion, you had intermarriage between Sunnis and Shias was not uncommon in villages where there's just one mosque. Sunnis and Shias worship together. It was really not a big deal until the invasion and occupation made it a big deal. And of course, Iran is taking advantage of it by bringing in Revolutionary Guard and a lot of folks. In fact, by abolishing the two secular institutions of Iraq, that is the civil service and the army, they were filled by these sectarian groups. The Iraqi ministries became fiefdoms of various mostly Shia sectarian factions. And then you have the armed forces were the core to build the new armed forces came out of the Badr Corps, which was the armed wing of a Shia party Skiri, which was recognized by Iran as Iraq's government exile. Their Badr Corps fought alongside Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, and indeed they were armed and trained, essentially created by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And so these are the people who used as the core to the new Iraqi army, and of course that encouraged the sectarian divisions that have plagued the country ever since. But what we did was we basically opened the country up to Iran, and ever since we've been vying with Iran for influence. Now, of course, most Iraqis, I mean, the big division in Iraq is not between Sunni and Shia as much as it is between nationalists and sectarians within both communities. Most Iraqis don't want, both Sunni and Shia, don't want this kind of sectarian division. They don't want to be dominated by the United States or Iraq. They've been engaged in this popular civil resistance campaign for several months now against the corrupt and repressive U.S. and Iranian-backed government, which has brutally suppressed them. But it's just another example of the blowback that starting with the overthrow of Iran's last democratic government in 1953 and bringing in the Shah from exile and the repression that he had and led to the Islamic Revolution. The policies of the U.S. have inadvertently strengthened this very reactionary Shia Iranian-backed tendency throughout the region.
Well, you know, we certainly didn't lose the Iraq War to such an extent that we ended up facing a Nuremberg. We didn't face a Nuremberg. There was no reckoning about it. We just kind of Obama perhaps might have had the opportunity to really create a reckoning, but he didn't have the constitution for it. And so here we are in that situation that you just described. The fact that even as we speak, you know, one of the two top tier Democrats is somebody who actually perpetrated this war that was started by Republicans, and is the Democrats, if he are nominated, will pay the price for that war. Let's turn our attention for a bit onto Saudi Arabia. That's a really, really interesting area. What is Saudi Arabia's role in all of this great catastrophe, if you want to call it something?
Well, you know, things we hear negative about Iran, about their authoritarianism, the suppression of women and religious minorities, their support for extremist groups, their intervention in other countries, all this kind of thing are true, but you can say all the, and of course they're fundamentalist, hardcore, theocratic system. I mean, all these are true, but you can say all those things about Saudi Arabia and more. In fact, in every single one of those issues, Saudi Arabia is worse. And yet we hear from President Trump nothing but praise for the Saudis, and then talk that Iran is somehow uniquely evil in that part of the world. But unfortunately, it's not just Trump. I remember because Bernie Sanders, while he explicitly condemned the authoritarianism and other problems in Cuba, acknowledged they had done some good things in health care and literacy. Biden said, "Oh, Obama, you know, never supported dictators." But in fact, not only under Obama did the U.S. sell billions of dollars to the Saudis, which is a far more repressive regime than Cuba, but when King Fahd died, he said had nothing but praise in an official White House statement marking his passing. Again, this is something that's been pursued by both parties for years. And in fact, the Democratic Party platform in 2016 calls for increased, but while going on and on about how terrible Iran is and even threatening war with Iran if they violated the nuclear agreement, had insisted on increasing U.S. ties and security cooperation with the Saudis and the other family dictatorships of the Gulf. So, this is an area where both parties have real issues. Now, I've been thankfully. Not only have Sanders and Warren spoken out about this, but an increasing number of Democrats, even Joe Biden now, has distanced himself somewhat from the his former support for the Saudis. But because of its important strategic location and its enormous wealth, it's been a blind spot for politicians of both parties, and it only. And despite their role in the deaths of tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians in recent years, it was the death of one Washington Post journalist by the regime that finally got some of the more mainstream elements of the Democratic Party and even some Republicans to say, enough is enough. We're tired of coddling these guys.
Well, that's what it takes to get the attention, and everything seems to be – we seem to have a machine that just keeps running and running and running and running despite the will of the people. In a best-case scenario, if we're looking to the future, what could be a possible resolution of the main issue – the main issue between existence of Israel and the Palestinians? Is there any way up and above and out of that dance that's been going on now for a long, long, long time?
Well, you know, for many years, the international consensus was a so-called two-state solution, that is a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, including East Jerusalem, that is the lands that Israel seized in the 1967 war. That would give the Palestinians only 23% of Palestine, but it was better than nothing. And that there'd be strict security guarantees for all, that there'd be no wholesale right of return for Palestinian refugees to what's now Israel, but there'd be support in resettling them in the West Bank and Gaza. But despite giving lip service to this, the United States did nothing as Israel continued to colonize the West Bank. This is a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. No occupying power can transfer its civilian population onto territory seized by military force. And it's radically changed the demographic of the West Bank. And the U.S. had this contradictory position of saying we are the sole mediators of the conflict while being the primary military, economic, and diplomatic backer of the occupying power. And then saying, oh, the two sides have to work it out among themselves. And even if one takes the position, as I have, that both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have equal rights to statehood and security and peace, there's this policy ignored the gross asymmetry in power between the most powerful economic and military power in the region and a disempowered people under occupation. And so and that's the reason we don't have peace. I mean, if you're going to be a mediator, you can't take sides the way the U.S. has, including vetoing no less than 42 U.N. Security Council resolutions, otherwise unanimous resolutions, raising concerns about Israeli violations of international law. And so with the U.S. saying, no, the U.N. can't get involved, and saying, no, we're not going to use military aid as a leverage. We will punish the Palestinians if they try to get recognition of their statehood in the U.N. or by other countries. We oppose civil society activism to end the occupation, such as the BDS movement. We only leave it to the so-called peace process between Palestinians, which, thanks to all of the above, have no leverage, and a right-wing Israeli government that's made it very clear it's not going to allow them a viable state one way or the other. So, there are a lot of us who worked for a two-state solution for more than 40 years who are now thinking and just being there in the West Bank, seeing how things are, that might be too late. Maybe we do need to start talking about a single binational state or some other alternative.
Yeah. I mean, because they certainly waited that one out and were able to continue to keep the U.S. In the pocket of Israel. And, you know, hey, I grew up in a Jewish family. As a kid, I loved Israel. I always wanted to go there and live, which I didn't do. But I admired it. And, you know, we've gone to a situation where their policies are so hugely toxic, and including the not just the treatment of the Palestinians, but in aligning themselves with some of the worst forces around the world. This is rather vexing. So let's imagine.
Very much so.
Go ahead.
Yeah, very much. I just wondered one thing I challenge you on a bit, though, is that it's not that the United States is in the pocket of Israel, that it's not a case of the tail wagging the dog. Let's remember the U.S. Supported Indonesia's occupation of East Timor, apartheid South Africa's occupation of Namibia, and we still support Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara. You know, we're quite willing to support our allies and invade, occupy, colonize, and oppress the weaker neighbors, you know, without an ethnic lobby forcing us to do so. It's not all AIPAC. It's very much, unfortunately, consistent with U.S. policy around the world.
I think that's a good perspective because, again, they didn't have any push from Israel to invade Iran in 1952. That had 53. That had nothing to do with Israel or anything like that. So It's purely that imperialist policy. And what seems to be vexing is that there are people on the conservative side, the conservative populist side, and people on the progressive side who both recognize the toxicity of American imperialism. And because they're on each of these two political polarities, they can't seem to actually work together to get any to actually have a breakthrough policy. Any ideas in that domain? Is there something happening that might have a transpartisan influence?
Well, I think nominating Bernie Sanders could help, because I think he's one person who could bring in the anti-imperialist left and the more libertarian isolationist wing as well, because if it's Biden or whatever, they're gonna go for Trump, because Trump has used the rhetoric of the more isolationist libertarian right to his advantage. I mean, for example, his supposed withdrawal of forces from Syria, he withdrew the ones that were protecting the Kurds and put them all around the oil fields in a different part of the country. And he's actually increased U.S. troops going to the Middle East, to Saudi Arabia, to supposedly protect them from the Iranians, even though Saudi Arabia is six times more powerful in terms of their military procurement than Iran is. But I remember after he announced that, he went to Texas for a rally and saying, "I'm bringing the troops home." And the crowd started chanting, "Bring the troops home! Bring the troops home! Bring the troops home!" I mean, remember, this is a Republican rally in Texas,
right? Exactly.
It shows there's been a real shift on the Republican side about intervention, and we can't if we nominate Biden, Trump is going to win on this issue, but if we nominate Sanders, who has a consistent anti-interventionist record, they can call out Trump on his hypocrisy and lies around this issue, then I think we can build a winning coalition.
You know, I think that the one thing that that Trump had that Bernie has is a plain spokenness. The difference, of course, is that Trump is a pathological liar and sociopath. That's the difference. But Bernie actually speaks real language to real people. He bangs away at the same issues over and over again. He's not going to be intimidated. People find him to be a candidate with integrity, whether they agree with him or not. And I think the major objections on the Democratic side, going back to your article that precipitated this interview, is that, oh, he can't be elected. And I think the progressive side of the Democratic Party has been beaten up so much that they can't even imagine what it would be like to possibly win.
Yes, and that's really, really disturbing. And you see it not only manifested, I think, in some of the vitriol between Warren supporters and Sanders supporters, which has been getting really, really nasty of late, but also the kind of view that of the progressives who are saying, since we can't win, I'm going to have to vote for Biden, and that is just the so counterproductive, because the best way to reelect Trump, I believe, is to nominate Joe Biden, and I really I do believe that Sanders is far more electable than he is come November.
Well, time will tell, and by the time you're listening to this, folks, we may see what the results are of Super Tuesday and so on. Anything on the horizon that you find particularly encouraging?
Well, I keep thinking about the power of ordinary people to affect change. I just recently got back from Sudan, which lived for 30 years under one of the most brutal dictatorships in the world, literally a genocidal regime, responsible for the horror in Darfur and other parts of the country, incredibly repressive. And yet a popular nonviolent uprising led by youth and women was able over a period of 8 months to overthrow the dictatorship there. And I figure if you can do something like that in a country like Sudan, you can do it anywhere, including here.
Thank you, Stephen Zunis. That's an encouraging word, an uprising, an upwising, where we wake up and wise up. Thanks, Stephen Zunis, for being our guest today on Wiki Politiki. We're back again next week.
Great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.